I'm Tim Gombas, and this is Faith Improvised. It's a podcast where I can think out loud and talk with friends about whatever interests me. Books, films, sports, music, culture, politics, the wonders and complexities of being Christian in this world, and my academic discipline, biblical studies. You're welcome to email me if you like at faithimprovised@gmail.com. In this episode, I recommend an absolutely powerful memoir that's a personal letter from a father to a son, and I talk about a few recent articles on the contemporary state of American evangelicalism. So I'm recording this standing in my office, looking out over the lake that sits at the middle of our campus. I may have said this before, but I have the most absolutely perfect office situation on this entire campus. It's gorgeous. I'm in here on Saturday because I'm finalizing grades for the last semester, and we're traveling a little bit this weekend over the next couple of days, so I wanted to record this today. Last night, we held our graduation for Grand Rapids Theological Seminary. The class of 2020 and the class of 2021, because last year we had to cancel the ceremony. We had a number of videos that various graduates made that we passed around, but we wanted to honor the people in person, and so we held a quite sizable graduation last night, and it was just the coolest celebration. And you know, personally, I don't like being around large crowds and with a lot of people and having to have a lot of small talk and that sort of thing. I find that quite unpleasant. But it was an absolute delight to be around loads of the people that I've had the great privilege and delight of journeying with through their educational path over the last several years, and who have become, for me, fellow students and great conversation partners. I know that I fulfill the role of professor of New Testament at this institution, but I do everything I can to posture myself as alongside of students because I see myself as a student. And we are just so privileged to have routinely a wonderful student body show up every year here. With really sharp people, people who are sort of dogged students of scripture, asking all kinds of awesome questions and doing loads of persistent and far-reaching research to get questions answered and to dig into the text. And I just find myself seldom being, quote unquote, the teacher, and often being a partner as people come to discover rich things in the New Testament collection of texts. So to celebrate with a bunch of people that were graduating was a real delight, and to see where people are going on from here is also just really cool as well. A woman named Jennifer graduated with high academic honors. She gave the student response last night, which I found quite moving and quite compelling. She's headed on to a PhD program in New Testament, which is very cool. Great things will be coming forth from her. I supervised her thesis 2 years ago, and then also she did a number of independent studies with me in the Greek text of John, the Greek text of Mark, and taught me loads. And yeah, it'll be cool to see what she does down the road. We had two THM graduates, that's a research degree. And Kyle is going on to a PhD program at Baylor University, and he graduated in Old Testament. And Jennifer graduated in New Testament, and it'll be cool to see what happens next for her. She presented her research in a paper form at the Eastern Great Lakes Regional SBL and won a student paper award for that. And I got to supervise that thesis, and it was just a rare piece of work for a master's student, even for a THM student. The expectation for THM level work is not always that you're going to push the field forward or make a unique contribution. So when that happens, it's really remarkable. And Jennifer's thesis did that. And on the household, sort of the Hausstaffel, household code frame, that's the German term, kind of the household code frame for reading First Peter, and just a superb piece of work, and a lot of food for thought. My goodness, if I just had far more time on my hands, I'd love to dive into First Peter and become sort of a routine conversation partner with Jennifer. Anyway, coming off another great academic year here at GRTS, I'm really spoiled to be ensconced in the academic community that I am. GRTS is a rare place. This is not a sales pitch. It's just a celebration. This is a rare place that has an evangelical identity, but is multi-denominational, and has an ethos of fearlessness about engaging critical questions and having hard conversations over complex issues. And it's a real delight to be here. A lot of that is down to our leadership. We have a great, I'm not trying to keep my job here, I'm just saying this. We have an unusual administration. The dean of our seminary is, this is rare in academic circles anywhere, but especially in evangelical institutions, I've discovered. He's not a scholar in some other field that got drafted into administrative duties. That is so common at academic institutions around the country and around the world, which is why so many academic institutions struggle with administrative efficiency. But our dean did his PhD in academic administration in one of the best programs in the country. And my goodness, his leadership style shows, and he's a person of unusual character. So he's got a lot of integrity as a real servant, and makes life for us faculty members here just an absolute delight. And that's great long-term vision, because if you've got happy faculty, you've got a really invested and excited student body community. So this is makes my life a breeze and a total delight. Also, we'll be going through a little bit of transition. Our president, the president of the overall university that GRTS is part of, is Joe Stoll for like two more weeks. He will be retiring, and he also is an instance of really unusual leadership quality, especially in evangelical university settings. Again, institutions that really struggle with strong leadership. And Joe has provided unusually strong leadership of this school. A lot of his efforts are committed to the undergraduate part of this larger institution. And because the seminary has a history of being really well run. But we also benefit from his strong leadership in that who knows how many crazy phone calls and angry emails he's received about me, I don't wanna know. And he's always been encouraging and supportive, you know, attentive to us when he needs to be, and always from a posture of having our backs. So I've been really grateful for his leadership during my time here. I was able just to say thank you to him the other day and told him that you know, this has been the best 10 years of my life, and that's really the case. Sarah and I and our kids moved to Grand Rapids 10 years ago, August 1st, 2011. And this has been a season of unusual flourishing for our family. So I've loved it. Anyway, coming off that great night, looking forward to a wonderful summer of research. And for me personally, I'll be diving into Romans big time with a couple writing projects. And a lot of Romans, and hopefully a lot of golf. We'll see what happens. And inevitably, a lot of baseball watching. And this year, a lot of, creative, profane combinations of words while I sit on the couch and yell at my television screen as the Cubs endure the season that is historically awful. They lost again last night. They've lost six out of the last seven games after winning four straight, which was great. But in the month of April, this is crazy. The Cubs have, in the history of Major League Baseball, like that's a long history, over 125 years. In the history of Major League Baseball, no team has ever struck out as much in April as the Cubs have. A bunch of these losses have been shutouts where they've had like two hits. This is just really, really brutal. Will I stop watching? No. This is what happens. You know, when you're a committed fan and when you're sort of affected and infected with this kind of commitment, we're going down swinging. Anyway, by the way, just a note to team president Jed Hoyer. I do have some free time this summer. We're doing some camping trips. We've got another big long road trip that we're taking. But I do have some time, and if you are interested in cutting payroll at all, I've got strong arms still. I'm agile. I remember my, double play drills, playing shortstop in high school, played mostly third base. I can play around the infield. I'll take a fraction of some of these players' salaries. And I also can strike out 4 to 5 times. I probably would struggle to hit major league pitching just like most batters in the Cubs lineup right now. So, Jed, if you want to fulfill my lifelong dream of playing Major League Baseball at Wrigley Field, you know where to find me. In music news, this was cool. A new Lord Huron album is about to drop, and a couple songs have been released early on that. And I've been listening to those over the last couple days as I've been grading papers. What's really cool is that there's really sweet continuity with the band's previous work, which I just love. Probably not for everybody, but I love this band, one of my absolute favorites. And part of that continuity involves their sound, and it's also thematic. So yes, songs about death, which is probably their most dominant topic. And sort of like the Coen films that are completely unsentimental about the way the world works and life and death. Lord Huron, beautiful music, gorgeous music, great lyrics, and no sentiments. Really good stuff. Check it out. By the way, that reminds me, this summer, so I was talking to my buddy Sean on the phone the other day, and just kind of throwing back and forth a bunch of Coen lines and reminiscences about certain scenes. And I decided that this summer, I'm going to make my way back through every Coen film, start from the beginning and just go chronological. Sean sent me a couple years ago one of those sort of coffee table books, kind of discussing every Coen film. And the kind of thing that it was an afternoon ruiner for me, because I picked that up and just start reading it and thinking through the film. Then I've got to watch the film and look for the nuances and try to track the themes that they are always drawing out. So that's going to be my summer. And I told Sarah about it today, and she said she would join me. So the summer, Romans, golf, Coens. And if I hear that the new Wes Anderson film, The French Dispatch, will be releasing, then I will draft the Wes Anderson au revoir into that project. We'll go back through those films. A couple of slightly more serious thoughts. Well, I've been very serious to this point. A couple of things that kind of struck me over the last week that I've been chewing on my morning walks. And one of those is the character of evangelical culture when it comes to people that leave evangelical culture. So I have not spent much time doing this at all. But the other day I ended up reading some reflections, really thoughtful. A person was sort of sharing a little bit of their personal experience of having spent decades in an evangelical environment and, being wounded and struggling and encountering the power dynamics and really abuse that can occur in a community like that. And this person was saying that they have decided to leave, that they're no longer where they were. They're no longer the person that they were, and they're taking a new direction. and this person wished others well and talked about maintaining friendships and all that. I just thought, wow, that's really interesting. And anytime that I ever am let in on somebody's deep personal pain and their personal narrative, the way that I view other people, I just think those are moments of holiness. That is when people dig deep and share from the reservoir of their trauma or their pain or their suffering or their hardship, and can even do so beautifully and artfully. Those are moments to just be quiet and sit before those experiences and be in awe. Because what lies behind all of that are sleepless nights, are moments of anxiety and stress and strain and fear and prizing of connections, and being fearful of taking steps because those connections may be severed. There's just so much that lies behind those kind of recountings. And to my mind, you know, people are just these infinite reservoirs of wonder. And if you ever get a window into another person's experience, that is holiness. And what blows my mind, this is the thing that blows my mind, is that there are inevitably a number of people who are still evangelical will respond to stories like that and feel the need to kind of weigh in, and will respond with comments that are so destructive or like denunciatory or spiteful and mean and angry. And it just blows my mind. It floors me. And I can't imagine anything other than people who respond that way are just radically bent and twisted humans, and they're captured by something powerful. And it seems to me that what's going on there is there's some behind those kind of reactions of fear and denunciation or shame or dismissiveness. There's at a subterranean level, there is powerful enslaving fear and anxiety, and especially fear that, this kind of low level, kind of low burning anxiety that maybe this whole thing isn't true, or maybe I've placed my faith in the wrong place, or, maybe I'm coming apart. This kind of need to hold on to something certain and solid is, you know, the underside of that is anxiety that maybe the thing that I'm holding on to for certainty and solidity, maybe it's not certain and solid. Maybe it's going to crack. Maybe I'm going to crack. And I think that those kind of fears and anxieties are projected outward. Or maybe there's some kind of anger that looking out on the world and being sort of free to do what you want and not feel bounded by remaining within an oppressive community, to see somebody just kind of cross that boundary and say, I'm not going to put up with this anymore. I'm going to live as a genuine human. I'm not going to be bent and distorted and put up with abuse. I think that another source could be just like the anger and resentment that somebody else is walking free. And again, that's some sort of a distorted imagination, kind of the deep-seated conviction that, and the knowledge that being in this community, holding to this way of seeing the world, ordering my life according to these community standards, it really does suck. I hate it. It's hateful. And the only thing that gives me any kind of a comfort is that other people are in it too. Other people's lives also suck. And other people also hate being this way. But at least I'm not alone. But then to see somebody just turn their back on it and walk towards freedom and to prefer flourishing, that I think that just provokes these vehement and vicious reactions of like just awful vituperation of like a Vesuvius of rage. I don't know, some of the stuff I read, I was like, man, and I have heard people talk that way. I have a dear friend who's an atheist, from way back in my childhood. We were friends and then reconnected recently. And she was saying that people that we both know from our youth group just said some awful stuff about her and said some awful stuff to her about, you know, how some difficult things happened in her life because she had walked away from the faith and over the course of some years has become an atheist. And she's like one of the funniest people that I know, just an absolute delight, love hanging out with her. She's also a Cubs fan. And she refuses to respond in kind, but was just expressing to me being baffled. How could somebody say these things to another person? And I have no idea. Anyway, I just, on my walk the other day, and a couple days, because I, you know, read this last week, and it just kind of made an impression on me. I just wonder at it. I stand before that reality and wonder. When someone shares their story, and you don't just respond by saying, "My word, I'm so happy for you that you are a soul experiencing freedom." That's all I can say. I think that it is an anti-Christian response. It's anything but Christian. I've had people share their stories with me, and all I ever say is, "Thank you for sharing. Thank you for honoring me by sharing your story with me. Anytime you want to talk, I'm here. I'll be a friend." Because that, in my understanding, is what it means to be a Christian, is to be a fully formed human and on the way to being fully formed. And that means honoring other people and loving them and welcoming them and cultivating a personal presence on an individual level, cultivating a personal presence of welcome and hospitality and love and envelopment and embrace and friendship and commitment. I'm not part of a sales team so that if somebody rejects the sale, I cut them off. There is something so dramatically messed up about that kind of a reality. Sadly, the culture in which I was raised does cultivate those kinds of people. Not always, but at times, it can cultivate a kind of people that are thoroughly convinced that Christianity sucks bad, but they don't want to go to hell when they die. And they're anxious the whole time that maybe it's all a fraud. I think there are better ways of being Christian. I've been convinced for some time that being Christian can actually be seen to be great. And I just wonder when I look around at other people that the way that they behave indicates that they're thoroughly convinced that it sucks, but also they have to talk about it as if it's great. I find that when they do, I'm bored to tears, because the things they find are great, I don't see all that great. But anyway, I've become quite comfortable as a person, with some ideological disconnects from the culture that I inherited. Anyway, just a thought. If somebody shares with you their story of any kind of a transformation, my word, you are being honored. And to my mind, I would respond as someone who was just given the most precious, precious gift. Okay, one last thing that I want to say before I get to a book recommendation. And that is about the discussion that I had several weeks ago about rethinking. The other night, a couple of friends and I were out for a beer. My friend Dan was talking about the book that I recommended, Adam Grant's book, Think Again. And he really enjoyed it. He read it, enjoyed it. We had some fun comments about it. And then I heard from a couple people just had some questions about it. And also, this comes from Philip, who emailed several really thoughtful questions. And so I wanted to take those thoughts and reflections on a walk and just kind of chew over them a little bit and see if I could arrive at some fruitful ways of thinking. But just to expand a little bit on that or draw that out a bit, when I'm talking about rethinking, I'm not necessarily talking about rethinking things like, say, the deity of Christ. Is Jesus God or is Jesus not God? That's not what I'm thinking. In fact, I want to be very careful when I say this. That kind of a question I find quite boring. And I find it not the kind of question that could lead to many places of fruitful reflection. I'm not talking about the kind of question, when I talk about rethinking, I'm not talking about the kind of questions like, is there a God or is there not? That's not a question that really grips me. And the reason I say that is because in many ways, those are framings of questions that are tried and familiar. We all know them. These are the kinds of questions that everybody entertains. And I'm not talking about rethinking sort of what I inherited doctrinally or theologically and thinking that my position is wrong, I need to choose the other position. What I'm talking about is rethinking the entire framework of imagining that there's a position with two options. Like stepping back from that whole scenario and asking, is that the best way to think about it? Or if we're thinking about the deity of Christ, is Christ God or not? That to me is not the kind of question that I will spend a whole lot of time on. What I think is far more interesting is what does it mean that Jesus is God? Or why don't any of the gospel writers just come out and say that if that's what the New Testament is supposed to be asserting? Why do they do it in such roundabout ways? What are they doing? And what kind of God is Jesus supposed to be? Because Scripture is not interested in asserting, certainly the New Testament is not interested in displaying the reality that Jesus is God. It's far more interested in demonstrating the reality that Jesus is the God of Israel, the covenant-keeping God, the covenant-making God, the covenant-keeping God, the God who is faithful to his people and has quite a complicated relationship with them. That's a more interesting thing to be rethinking. How does that exactly work? And in light of that whole study that I've sort of gone on, been engaged in over the last 20 years at the provocation of Tom Wright's work, should we even talk about God anymore without talking about the God of Israel? What's really interesting is in N.T. Wright's book, The New Testament and the People of God, he types the word God in lowercase throughout, I think, the entire book, or at least much of it, which is so fascinating, so utterly interesting. I just love it. And the reason why is because he says that that's probably the term in the English language that's the most misunderstood. There's almost no content to that term. And all the content that we have to that term is just badly thought out. Okay, that is exactly the place I love to be when I talk about rethinking. Like, all right, you just set the table to do some pretty serious, interesting rethinking, and I'm showing up for that. Just put everything on the table and take off the table all the boring as hell questions and get to the real ones that are fascinating. And those are the kind of questions I'm really interested in. Beyond that, these are the kind of questions that I am always probing, and mostly questions about it, sort of like what I just was talking about. I asked this a number of years ago because it just bothered me. Like this, you know, the culture that I inherited, and certainly at the time, the institution that I was working at before I arrived at GRTS, one of the big questions I had is why does it seem like, why is there so many angry conservative white evangelicals? Like there are just so many angry people. In fact, as a community, these are just the angriest people I've ever been around. What is the deal with that? Why is it that as like a set of community dynamics, this people is embodying the reality that it just blows to be Christian. But we're Christian, and all the other people know that it blows, and we all hate each other, but we're all in it. So, I mean, just like, what is the deal with that? Why is it that so many Christians are angry? And I don't know, that's the kind of question I think that demands rethinking. It's one thing to say sort of the evangelical package of truth is all reliably true. It's just that some people don't embody it rightly. I don't buy that. I think it's the case that if the kind of communities that are instantiated by evangelical theology are just angry, mean, nasty, hollowed out, shallow communities, there's actually something wrong with the theology.
And so that's actually something that I would want to rethink. Is it possible to have, quote unquote, like correct theology, but to be embodying it wrongly? And I'm not at all convinced that that's possible. So when I'm talking about rethinking, I'm talking about revisiting assumptions that are up and running in my culture and that I inherited. And I'm thinking of things I've heard my entire life. And I want to talk about a few more of these, the kinds of things that I often rethink and am constantly rethinking. This is just a smattering that is exemplary. And also, yes, if the sound quality just changed, I recorded that last segment with the wrong microphone. It's late in the day on Saturday. I'm tempted to somehow fix that up, but hopefully it wasn't too awful. These are the kind of questions that I've wanted to rethink and that I've rethought over the years. Why do people say things like this? Christians, we say this all the time. When someone gives us a difficult situation, we say something, well, you should pray about it. Why? Why should you pray about it? What would happen if you prayed about it? Would things change? Would your posture change? I don't know. I think that is the kind of question it'd be great to actually try to answer. What is supposed to happen through prayer? What are our expectations about prayer? It's just very simplistic. I don't think we think strategically enough about prayer, about praying, and think unsentimentally about it without a kind of a saccharine optimism. I think we need to think in a far more brutal sense about prayer and actually follow the contours of Scripture and sort of examples of prayer. Most of the time when biblical characters run into trouble, they either cry out to God and say, help, or cry out to God and say, what is the deal? If that's what people mean by praying about it, I guess I'm on board. Here's another thing that I've kind of wondered over the years. What if I don't like praying? I'm not talking about believing in prayer or not believing in prayer. I'm talking about liking it. Like, what if I don't like to pray? Is that okay? What if I find it helpful to go through the prayer book in church? I'm part of a liturgical congregation with a wonderfully rich liturgical heritage, and I say amen at the end, and that's I'm praying with the church. I'm reading the church's prayers, or I'm hearing the church's prayers read, and I say amen at the end. Is that not sufficient? If not, why not? Where did we get the rules for how often I should be praying or we should be praying? And why is it necessary for everybody to like it or to feel that they're good at it? Or is it okay to just say I'm bad at praying? Is it okay to just pray super simple prayers? Like to hear about a situation and just think, Lord, have mercy. And that's it. Why not attend to what Jesus says about not just sort of, bursting forth from the mouth when we pray? I think there's a lot of wisdom to that, in my opinion. What about read prayers? That is to say, what about prayers that are constructed by others very thoughtfully for us to inhabit and to enter into? I really enjoyed the years when I was constructing prayer services for our church, or when I would construct the opening and the prayers weekly at our church. that was my praying as I worked on those throughout the week. And I really enjoyed it. I entered into it fully. I tried to do those artfully. And those exercises meant a lot to me. I am one of those people that finds it difficult to pray. And I don't feel guilty about that or badly about it. I think that there are good theological reasons and sort of humane and human reasons for being really honest about the character of prayer. I think a lot of the wisdom that sort of is up and running in the culture that I inherited is in desperate need of being rethought. But prayer is kind of one of those areas that's sort of a sacred cow. So you're not supposed to say out loud, "Hey, I don't like praying. So what?" Or, James's exhortation to pray for wisdom. Have we thought enough about how wisdom is actually received? In the Proverbs, wisdom comes from God, and wisdom is the fear of the Lord. But like on an Eastern view of things, there are more things at one time that are true than just one thing. And on one hand, wisdom comes from God, but wisdom comes from God through people, usually old people. So are we praying for the character to be able to receive and seek out wisdom from people that are in our lives? Or are we praying to receive some kind of magic revelation? I don't know. But I don't think that we're often prepared to think rightly about stuff like that. Somebody wrote me an email the other day and said, was asking a certain question and asked about my time alone with the Lord. And the question, that was the first part of their question, and they went along to talk about something else. And so I answered that question without mentioning time alone with the Lord. What does that even mean? I frankly don't have a quiet time. For my job, I study the Bible and I love it. And my mind is always sort of, filled with questions or pondering passages and kind of pressing them into the far corners of my imagination and learning to see the world through the lens of Scripture. And I don't see any bifurcation at all between like a spiritual devotional life on one hand and like an academic life on the other hand. I'm a whole person. Body, mind, soul. I mean, I am whole, and I'm in a long-term project of becoming whole. I'm not interested at all in further divisions between like spirituality and academics. To me, it's all the same. It's all getting to grips with reality and pressing into reality. And furthermore, spirituality in the Bible is, joyful participation among the people of God. Cultivating a heart of openness to others and generosity of spirit and developing those connections. Time alone with God, quote unquote, is a thoroughly modern phenomenon. And it's not anything that, frankly, it's not anything I'm interested in. I spend plenty of time alone, as much time alone as I can get. And I love it. And I'm often thinking about a variety of things. I'm often just inhabiting intense gratitude for the good things that I have in my life, which is an intentionally cultivated posture. And very often on my walks, this is my prayer life. I will just sort of lift up my hands and say, thank you. Thank you for my life. And, list out some of the good things and then just say, thank you again. But anyway, just to say that received wisdom in our heritage of having to have a certain kind of a time alone with God that goes a certain way and has certain components, those don't work for every personality type, and those don't work for all people everywhere. And where did they come from anyway? Who invented these? Another thing that I was thinking I think needs to be rethought is something that I heard just the other day and just brought to mind my just wondering why we go in a certain direction about this. When Jesus' statement in John 14, when he says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes to the Father but through me." And in seminary, that was very obviously a proof text for the exclusivity of Christianity, that Jesus is the only way to the Father. All other religions are corrupt, inadequate, they won't bring you to God, etc. Is that really the best way to think about that text, is to take it in that direction? I frankly don't think so. That passage comes in a context. So here's the levels at which I think that needs to be rethought. That imagines a scenario of Christians kind of looking out on the world and saying, y'all are blind and heading down blind alleys and dead end streets, and you're headed for destruction. We're the only ones that have the truth. We're the only ones that have it. Jesus is the only way to God. All of you are just kind of following these deceptions and lies. That seems to me, if you read the whole passage, to be nowhere in view in what is going on in this text. I'm not saying that all religions lead equally to God. I'm just saying, here's the rethinking. Why is that discussion even in view when we quote that passage? Or why do we feel we need to have that discussion? That's another way to take that text is for either me to say, if I'm thinking about it for myself, or for us all to say, if we're thinking about it as a gathered social body that is the church, hey, y'all, the way of Jesus is the way that claims our lives. That is the only way that we can consider. That's how we need to live. We need to live in a way that inhabits the love of Jesus for his people, that inhabits the love that Jesus and the Father enjoy together. And at least in John 14, 15 and beyond, the way that Jesus is inhabited in John, that's a unique theology in John, or at least his emphases are unique. The way that we inhabit Jesus is to love one another. So, and to imitate his servant orientation. That's the only way that we can live. We can't entertain a self-seeking way of life, y'all. I mean, that's kind of self-talk for the church. That's sort of rethinking that statement instead of turning it into a statement that fosters an arrogant posture on the part of the church toward the world. It's a statement that sets, that kind of brings the church up short and confronts it with the reality that the only way of life for us is the Jesus way of life. Don't worry about other people. I mean, this is what Jesus says to, who's it, to John or to Peter? To Peter about John or John about Peter at the end of John. Don't worry about him. You know your call. Don't worry about him. Don't worry. And this is Jesus' words to the church. Don't worry about others. You know, love them too. But for you, this is the only way of life for you to think about. Anyway, I'm going on and on and on about examples of rethinking. I just tried to come up with a bunch of these. I'll just give one last one here. Why not? Inerrancy. Is inerrancy the best way to think about the Bible? Inerrancy is sort of an evangelical sine qua non. That is, without it, evangelicalism doesn't exist. And certainly theologically, it's become a sine qua non, and it's part of the doctrinal statement of this institution. But I think it's really helpful to understand the history of that discussion. Inerrancy was developed by fundamentalists in the early part of the 20th century, the closing part of the 19th century, and evangelicals in response to higher criticism coming from Germany and Europe. And it was a way of kind of saying, with regard to the question, are there errors in the Bible? No, there are not errors in the Bible. We believe in the Bible's inerrancy was the response. Now, frankly, when it comes to just thinking about the Bible afresh, just kind of like out of nowhere, without thinking about the history of fights that evangelicals have had, I have to say that inerrancy is probably the most anemic way to think about the Bible. It's sort of a negative doctrine. We sort of look over to the side as we're going forward in at least evangelicalism historically and see that there are some folks over there saying there are errors in this book. And evangelicals said, no, there are not errors in this book. And then we keep kind of moving forward. That's how I picture inerrancy. But inerrancy is not a theology or a doctrine to kind of build anything on. think about what the Bible is. The Bible is a set of texts meant to be inhabited and meant to shape our imagination and meant to kind of shape the way that we see ourselves in this world. There's poetry. There are recountings from perspective. I mean, from certain perspectives. I want to say histories, but in a sense, they're not histories as we might understand them. Modern people might understand them. They have theological aims and purposes. There's all kinds of different sorts of literature. And I mean, I was thinking last night, you know, several years ago, one of our sons wrote to us just a powerfully meaningful letter and meant the world to Sarah and to me. It was just really, really cool. The kind of thing that you just think, my goodness, for a child to pour that out to a parent, you know, that's the kind of parent I want to be. I'm not holding myself up as an example. I'm just saying, all right, that's a massive win. We're just so glad that in view of all the mistakes that we made as parents, that we can have this kind of relationship with our kids, that they will just share so frankly and freely of themselves. And it just was really cool. I kept that letter, obviously, just treasure it. I think it's probably one of the most pathetic, meaningless things to say about that letter, to say there are no errors in that letter. What would be the point of that? I mean, that letter was powerful. It was meaningful. It reconfigured and deepened our relationship with our son. It opened up some things between us and our son. It just had a powerful effect. To say that there are no errors in it is the most, I cannot imagine a more irrelevant statement, except to say something like, what flavor of mustard is that letter? Or something along those lines. I mean, just there's an irrelevance there that is utterly pointless. And the same thing about, say, in a time when life is crushing, resonating with a lament psalm and having that powerfully shape how you think about the world and how you think about yourself and how you think about God's place in all of it, or being given the language from some lament psalms to cry out and just grieve over God's felt absence. I mean, there are passages of scripture that I can't read without just melting down. They've been powerful in my own narrative. And they're powerful because they're beautifully put together. And they call out and give words to some of the deepest impulses of what it means to be human. And to say about some of those passages, there are no errors in that passage, it's just a non-starter. I don't get it. I understand it historically. I understand the fights out of which that doctrine arose. So anyway, I'm saying all this to say, these are the kinds of things I think are worthy of rethinking, and there are about 800 more, and the ways I think things need to be rethought. And by the way, I'm not even talking about disavowing certain doctrines or like throwing them out or saying I've got to move away from that or something like that. Mostly I'm talking about asking questions like, why? Why do we say that about that? To say that about that doesn't seem all that life-giving, or it doesn't seem compelling. It doesn't give me hope. It doesn't lift my spirits. It's just a fact that I receive. And the reality about the Christian faith as it's in the Christian dynamic of community, as I see it on the pages of the New Testament, is designed to bring comfort, to fire hope, to bring relief, to foster liberation. And so the realities that we inhabit and the doctrines that we talk about ought to all move in that direction. And if they are mere facts that sort of lie lifelessly on the floor, I think it's worth asking why. Why does that do that? What's the deal with it? What's wrong with how we're currently thinking about this, that it just generates a big yawn? So anyway, thanks, Dan, for firing some thoughts just out of our conversation the other night, and Philip from that email. When I'm talking about rethinking, largely it's sort of done from a posture of commitment to my community, not from a commitment to, or from a posture like if this doesn't end up intellectually compelling, I'm out of here. But mostly from a posture of, I don't really understand why that's compelling, or that isn't compelling to me, and I want to know a better way of thinking about it. It comes from that kind of posture, and mostly from a posture of thinking that the ways that we're currently thinking about a certain topic, and even the options for thinking about it, are probably not all that can be said about it. There's probably a better way of thinking. And I want to get there. I want to get there. And so that's why I loved Adam Grant's book, because it kind of exposed the fact that it's possible. It's possible to actually to rethink things and to think again and to think about better ways of doing things and to arrive at more fruitful ways of thinking. I love that posture of questioning from even within the Christian faith, because for me, it doesn't generate an anxiety that I might leave it. I was talking to a student named Jerry the other day, and she was saying that when she came to faith in college, when she became a Christian in college, she immediately became convinced, like, if this is the truth, then we can just pelt it and beat it up with all of our most intense questions. And if it survives, then good. And if it doesn't, then just chuck it. And I was like, yeah, that's it. Let's really go at things. And even while we're not necessarily arriving at better ways of thinking or, satisfying answers to all our questions, you know, hold out for it, wait for it. Better ways of thinking may arrive. So I don't do that from a posture of fear. I do it from a posture of hopeful expectation. Anyway, I've gone on long. Obviously, this has occupied a lot of my mind over the last week or so. So there it is. I want to tell you about a book. It's called Between the World and Me, and the author is Ta-Nehisi Coates, and it's published by Spiegel & Grau, an imprint of Random House. It's a highly regarded work, and it won the National Book Award a few years ago. It's one of the most powerful books I've read in the last 5 or 6 years, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. No less a literary authority than Toni Morrison said, it's required reading. The book is something of a memoir, and it's highly personal because it's written to a son about the experience of being Black in America, of what it's like to be a Black male body in this nation. Coates writes beautifully, and this is one of his most effective and affecting literary strategies. He writes about bodies, Black male bodies and Black female bodies, and how a white supremacist America treats those bodies as disposable and expendable. Black male bodies are dangerous and have become the sites of unspeakable violence, and this is what he tries to impress on his son. He doesn't want his son to become hardened and cynical or full of hate. And this is his challenge, how to foster a young man full of love and hope and generosity while also alerting him to the dangerous reality of being a Black male body in America. I want to read a particularly powerful passage from early on in the book. I write you in your 15th year. I'm writing you because this was the year you saw Eric Garner choked to death for selling cigarettes. Because you know now that Renisha McBride was shot for seeking help, that John Crawford was shot down for browsing in a department store, and you have seen men in uniform drive by and murder Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old child whom they were oath-bound to protect, and you have seen men in the same uniforms pummel Marlene Pinnock, someone's grandmother, on the side of a road. And you know now, if you did not know before, that the police departments of your country have been endowed with the authority to destroy your body. It does not matter if the destruction is the result of an unfortunate overreaction. It does not matter if it originates in a misunderstanding. It does not matter if the destruction springs from a foolish policy. Sell cigarettes without the proper authority, and your body can be destroyed. Resent the people trying to entrap your body, and it can be destroyed. Turn into a dark stairwell, and your body can be destroyed. The destroyers will rarely be held accountable. Mostly, they will receive pensions. And destruction is merely the superlative form of a dominion whose prerogatives include friskings, detainings, beatings, and humiliations. All of this is common to black people, and all of this is old for black people. No one is held responsible. There is nothing uniquely evil in these destroyers or even in this moment. The destroyers are merely men enforcing the whims of our country, correctly interpreting its heritage and legacy. It is hard to face this, but all our phrasing, race relations, racial chasm, racial justice, racial profiling, white privilege, even white supremacy, serves to obscure that racism is a visceral experience, that it dislodges brains, blocks airways, rips muscle, extracts organs, cracks bones, breaks teeth. You must never look away from this. You must always remember that the sociology, the history, the economics, the graphs, the charts, the regressions all land with great violence upon the body. Powerful stuff. I've said before that idolatry always destroys bodies, and this is a perfect and awful instance of it. The idolatry of whiteness destroys non-white bodies, especially black bodies. And by whiteness, I mean the reality that our nation and the whole world now has inherited a way of seeing the world through the centering of white bodies, with white male bodies at the absolute center. We've all inherited this idolatrous and destructive ideology with its associated practices and social patterns. It's not merely about individual attitudes, but about our racially stratified society with its systemic dynamics of oppression and exploitation. And this idolatry destroys. And Coates' letter to his son is a powerful account of the personal costs of that idolatry. One of those costs is that black fathers have to have the talk with their sons about what to do when stopped by the police. I've never even thought of having that conversation with my boys. If you want a window into our racialized society and the personal traumas that it inflicts upon people, this book is an excellent place to start. It's powerfully moving. If you're a white person reading it and are open to cultivating a heart of compassion, it will be compelling and haunting. But if you're a white person reading it, and I cannot urge you strongly enough to do so, hold your emotional reaction in reserve. Yes, our hearts must be softened and we must cultivate compassion. But the world doesn't need our emotions, nor do black people in America. They need us to see the world as it is and ourselves as we are. Read it to learn about what's been done to all of us by the ideology of whiteness that has descended over the world and has left its twisted and terrible mark on all of us in the form of our distorted imaginations. The book is Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. Get it as ever from an independent bookstore. Well, this episode ran longer than I thought. That is, just some early reflections ran a whole lot longer than I thought they were going to do. I was going to just kind of talk about a few things for 15 minutes, but ended up kind of blowing some smoke for longer than I had planned. So I'm going to save what I was going to talk about for another time. And I'm heading home and we're grilling out tonight, because it's an absolutely gorgeous Saturday evening. It was raining a little bit earlier, but that's blown over. And I have to head home, pull some weeds up, maybe cut the grass, and then we're grilling. And hope that for wherever you are, it's actually a beautiful day. Don't let it get away.